Chapter 23. It was that memorable night when, according to the history of the veteran Betterton, asterisk Mrs. Barry, who personated Roxana, had a green room squabble with Mrs. Botell, the representative of Statira, about a veil, which the partiality of the property man adjudged to the latter. Roxana suppressed her rage till the fifth act, when, stabbing Statira, she aimed the blow with such force as to pierce through her stays and inflict a severe, though not dangerous wound. Mrs. Botell fainted, the performance was suspended, and, in the commotion which this incident caused in the house, many of the audience rose, and Stanton among them. It was at this moment that, in a seat opposite to him, he discovered the object of his search for 4 years, the Englishman whom he had met in the plains of Valencia, and whom he believed the same with the subject of the extraordinary narrative he had heard there. Asterisk Vide Betterton's history of the stage. He was standing up. There was nothing particular or remarkable in his appearance, but the expression of his eyes could never be mistaken or forgotten. The heart of Stanton palpitated with violence, a mist overspread his eye, a nameless and deadly sickness, accompanied with a creeping sensation in every pore, from which cold drops were gushing, announced the Before he had well recovered, a strain of music, soft, solemn, and delicious, breathed round him, audibly ascending from the ground, and increasing in sweetness and power till it seemed to fill the whole building. Under the sudden impulse of amazement and pleasure, he inquired of some around him from whence those exquisite sounds arose. But, by the manner in which he was answered, it was plain that those he addressed considered him insane, and, indeed, the remarkable change in his expression might well justify the suspicion. He then remembered that night in Spain, when the same sweet and mysterious sounds were heard only by the young bridegroom and bride, of whom the latter perished on that very night. And am I then to be the next victim? Thought Stanton. And are those celestial sounds, that seem to prepare us for heaven, only intended to announce the presence of an incarnate fiend, who mocks the devoted with airs from heaven, apostrophe while he prepares to surround them with blasts from hell? It is very singular, that at this moment, when his imagination had reached its highest pitch of elevation, when the object he had pursued so long and fruitlessly, had in one moment become as it were tangible to the grasp both of mind and body, when the spirit, with whom he had wrestled in darkness, was at last about to declare its name, that Stanton began to feel a kind of disappointment at the futility of his pursuits, like Bruce at discovering the source of the Nile, or Gibbon on concluding his history. The feeling which he had dwelt on so long, that he had actually converted it into a duty, was after all mere curiosity. But what passion is more insatiable, or more capable of giving a kind of romantic grandeur to all its wanderings and eccentricities? Curiosity is in one respect like love, it always compromises between the object and the feeling. And provided the latter possesses sufficient energy, no matter how contemptible the former may be. A child might have smiled at the agitation of Stanton, caused as it was by the accidental appearance of a stranger. But no man, in the full energy of his passions, was there, but must have trembled at the horrible agony of emotion with which he felt approaching, with sudden and irresistible velocity, the crisis of his destiny. When the play was over, he stood for some moments in the deserted streets. It was a beautiful moonlight night, and he saw near him a figure, whose shadow, projected half across the street. There were no flagged ways then, chains and posts were the only defense of the foot passenger, appeared to him of gigantic magnitude. He had been so long accustomed to contend with these phantoms of the imagination, that he took a kind of stubborn delight in subduing them. He walked up to the object, and observing the shadow only was magnified, and the figure was the ordinary height of man, he approached it, and discovered the very object of his search, the man whom he had seen for a moment in Valencia, and, after a search of 4 years, recognized at the theater. You were in quest of me?
I was.
Have you anything to inquire of me?
Much. Speak, then. This is no place.
No place.
Poor wretch,
I am independent of time and place.
Speak, if you have anything to ask or to learn.
I have many things to ask, but nothing to learn, I hope, from you.
You deceive yourself, but you will be undeceived when next we meet.
And when shall that be?
Said Stanton, grasping his arm.
Name your hour and your place.
The hour shall be midday, answered the stranger, with a horrid and unintelligible smile,
and the place shall be the bare walls of a madhouse, where you shall rise rattling in your chains, and rustling from your straw, to greet me,
yet still you shall have the curse of sanity, and of memory.
My voice shall ring in your ears till then, and the glance of these eyes shall be reflected from every object, animate or inanimate, till you behold them again.
Is it under circumstances so horrible we are to meet again?
Said Stanton, shrinking under the full lighted blaze of those demon eyes.
I never, said the stranger, in an emphatic tone, I never desert my friends in misfortune.
When they are plunged in the lowest abyss of human calamity, they are sure to be visited by me.
The narrative, when Melmoth was again able to trace its continuation, described Stanton, some years after, plunged in a state the most deplorable.
He had been always reckoned of a singular turn of mind, and the belief of this, aggravated by his constant talk of Melmoth, his wild pursuit of him, his strange behavior at the theater, and his dwelling on the various particulars of their extraordinary meetings, with all the intensity of the deepest conviction, while he never could impress them on anyone's conviction but his own, suggested to some prudent people the idea that he was deranged. Their malignity probably took part with their prudence.
The selfish FRENCHMAN* says, we feel a pleasure even in the misfortunes of our friends, a plus forte in those of our enemies, and as everyone is an enemy to a man of genius of course, the report of Stanton's malady was propagated with infernal and successful industry.
Stanton's next relative, a needy unprincipled man, watched the report in its circulation, and saw the snares closing round his victim. He waited on him one morning, accompanied by a person of a grave, though somewhat repulsive appearance. Stanton was as usual abstracted and restless, and, after a few moments' conversation, he proposed a drive a few miles out of London, which he said, would revive and refresh him.
Stanton objected, on account of the difficulty of getting a hackney coach,
for it is singular, that at this period the number of private equipages, though infinitely fewer than they are now, exceeded the number of hired ones,
and proposed going by water. This, however, did not suit the kinsman's views, and, after pretending to send for a carriage which was in waiting at the end of the street, Stanton and his companions entered it, and drove about 2 miles out of London. *Rishfow called. The carriage then stopped.
Come, cousin, said the younger Stanton, come and view a purchase I have made.
Stanton absently alighted, and followed him across a small paved court. The other person followed.
In troth, cousin, said Stanton, your choice appears not to have been discreetly made. Your house has somewhat of a gloomy aspect.
Hold you content, cousin, replied the other. I shall take order that you like it better when you have been some time a dweller there.
Some attendants of a mean appearance, and with most suspicious visages, awaited them on their entrance, and they ascended a narrow staircase, which led to a room meanly furnished.
Wait here, said the kinsman, to the man who accompanied them, till I go for company, to divertise my cousin in his loneliness.
They were left alone.
Stanton took no notice of his companion, but as usual seized the first book near him, and began to read. It was a volume in manuscript, they were then much more common than now. The first line struck him as indicating insanity in the writer.
It was a wild proposal written apparently after the Great Fire of London, to rebuild it with stone, and attempting to prove, on a calculation wild, false, and yet sometimes plausible, that this could be done out of the colossal fragments of Stonehenge, which the writer proposed to remove for that purpose. Subjoined were several grotesque drawings of engines designed to remove those massive blocks, and in a corner of the page was a note, "I would have drawn these more accurately, but was not allowed a knife to mend my pen." The next was entitled, "A Modest Proposal for the Spreading of Christianity in Foreign Parts, whereby it is hoped its entertainment will become general all over the world." This modest proposal was, to convert the Turkish ambassadors who had been in London a few years before, by offering them their choice of being strangled on the spot, or becoming Christians. Of course the writer reckoned on their embracing the easier alternative, but even this was to be clogged with a heavy condition, namely, that they must be bound before a magistrate, to convert 20 Muslims a day, on their return to Turkey. The rest of the pamphlet was reasoned very much in the conclusive style of Captain Bobadil, "These 20 will convert 20 more apiece, and these 200 converts, converting their due number in the same time, all Turkey would be converted before the Grand Signior knew where he was." Then comes the coup d'éclat. One fine morning, every minaret in Constantinople was to ring out with bells, instead of the cry of the muezzins, and the imam, coming out to see what was the matter, was to be encountered by the Archbishop of Canterbury, in pontificalibus, performing cathedral service in the Church of St. Sophia, which was to finish the business. Here an objection appeared to arise, which the ingenuity of the writer had anticipated. "It may be redarged," saith he, "by those who have more spleen than brain, that forasmuch as the Archbishop preacheth in English, he will not thereby much edify the Turkish folk, who do altogether hold in a vain gabble of their own. But this, to use his own language, he evites, by judiciously observing, that where service was performed in an unknown tongue, the devotion of the people was always observed to be much increased thereby. As, for instance, in the Church of Rome, that St. Augustine, with his monks, advanced to meet King Ethelbert singing litanies in a language his majesty could not possibly have understood, and converted him, and his whole court on the spot, that the Sibylline books, cum multis alias, between the pages, were cut most exquisitely in paper the likenesses of some of these Turkish ambassadors. The hair of the beards, in particular, was feathered with a delicacy of touch that seemed the work of fairy fingers, but the pages ended with a complaint of the operator that his scissors had been taken from him. However, he consoled himself and the reader with the assurance that he would that night catch a moonbeam as it entered through the grating, and, when he had wetted it on the iron knobs of his door, would do wonders with it. In the next page, was found a melancholy proof of powerful but prostrated intellect. It contained some insane lines, ascribed to Lee the dramatic poet, commencing, "Oh that my lungs could bleed like buttered peas, and see, there is no proof whatever, that these miserable lines were really written by Lee, except that the measure is the fashionable quatrain of the period. It is singular, that Stanton read on without suspicion of his own danger, quite absorbed in the album of a madhouse, without ever reflecting on the place where he was, and which such compositions too manifestly designated. It was after a long interval, that he looked round, and perceived that his companion was gone. Bells were unusual then. He proceeded to the door, it was fastened. He called aloud, his voice was echoed in a moment by many others, but in tones so wild and discordant, that he desisted in involuntary terror. As the day advanced, and no one approached, he tried the window, and then perceived for the first time it was grated. It looked out on the narrow flagged yard, in which no human being was, and if there had, from such a being no human feeling could have been extracted. Sickening with unspeakable horror, he sunk rather than sat down beside the miserable window, and wished for day.
At midnight he started from a doze, half a swoon, half a sleep, which probably the hardness of his seat, and of the deal table on which he leaned, had not contributed to prolong. He was in complete darkness. The horror of his situation struck him at once, and for a moment he was indeed almost qualified for an inmate of that dreadful mansion. He felt his way to the door, shook it with desperate strength, and uttered the most frightful cries, mixed with expostulations and commands. His cries were in a moment echoed by 100 voices. In maniacs there is a peculiar malignity, accompanied by an extraordinary acuteness of some of the senses, particularly in distinguishing the voice of a stranger. The cries that he heard on every side seemed like a wild and infernal yell of joy that their mansion of misery had obtained another tenant. He paused, exhausted. A quick and thundering step was heard in the passage. The door was opened, and a man of savage appearance stood at the entrance. Two more were seen indistinctly in the passage. "Release me, villain!" "Stop, my fine fellow, what's all this noise for? Where am I?"
"Where you ought to be."
"Will you dare to detain me?"
"Yes, and a little more than that," answered the ruffian, applying a loaded horsewhip to his back and shoulders, till the patient soon fell to the ground convulsed with rage and pain.
"Now you see you are where you ought to be," repeated the ruffian, brandishing the horsewhip over him, "and now take the advice of a friend, and make no more noise. The lads are ready for you with the darbies, and they'll clink them on in the crack of this whip, unless you prefer another touch of it first." They then were advancing into the room as he spoke, with fetters in their hands, straight waistcoats being then little known or used, and showed, by their frightful countenances and gestures, no unwillingness to apply them. Their harsh rattle on the stone pavement made Stanton's blood run cold. The effect, however, was useful. He had the presence of mind to acknowledge his supposed miserable condition, to supplicate the forbearance of the ruthless keeper, and promise complete submission to his orders. This pacified the ruffian, and he retired. Stanton collected all his resolution to encounter the horrible night. He saw all that was before him, and summoned himself to meet it. After much agitated deliberation, he conceived it best to continue the same appearance of submission and tranquility, hoping that thus he might in time either propitiate the wretches in whose hands he was, or, by his apparent inoffensiveness, procure such opportunities of indulgence as might perhaps ultimately facilitate his escape. He therefore determined to conduct himself with the utmost tranquility, and never to let his voice be heard in the house, and he laid down several other resolutions with a degree of prudence which he already shuddered to think might be the cunning of incipient madness, or the beginning result of the horrid habits of the place. These resolutions were put to desperate trial that very night. Just next to Stanton's apartment were lodged two most uncongenial neighbors. One of them was a puritanical weaver, who had been driven mad by a single sermon from the celebrated Hugh Peters, and was sent to the madhouse as full of election and reprobation as he could hold, and fuller. He regularly repeated over the 5 Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.